Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good afternoon, everyone. Okay, today we will continue with our study of the Sutta Nipata. And now we come to a sutta on page 20 of the printed edition that we've been using. This sutta is called in Pali the Vijaya Sutta. The word Vijaya means simply victory. And what's interesting is that if you read the sutta itself, you don't see anything in the sutta that speaks about a battle, a struggle, a fight. Nothing that ostensibly suggests the idea of a victory. And yet somehow the compilers of this collection, the Sutta Nipata, saw a reason to assign the title victory to the sutta. So that raises the question, what is the victory that is being indirectly referred to in the sutta? I would say that it is the victory over all of the delusions and defilements that arise centered around the body, especially the defilements of ignorance and craving. And this brings up the topic of the role of the body, the human body, in Buddhism. Now, early Buddhism doesn't teach an attitude of hatred or aversion towards the body. In India, during the time of the Buddha, one of the main modes of spiritual practice was the affliction of torment, of suffering on the body, with the idea that it was through self-mortification that one could purify oneself and gain liberation. It was thought that the desires of the body were the source of all bondage, all suffering, and so it was thought that by tormenting the body, that one could eliminate these desires and become purified. The Buddha himself had tried this approach before his enlightenment, going on long fasts, exposing his body to the heat of the sun, the cold of the winter, sleeping on thorns, and he found that it was not effective. Instead, he saw that the way to eliminate the defilements is through training the mind. So according to Buddhism, the body is not the source of evil. It is not intrinsically sinful. And in Buddhism, there's no duality of a pure soul versus a sinful body, the sins of the flesh. That expression in Christianity doesn't have any meaning in Buddhism. Because according to Buddhism, it is the mind that is the source of all of our defilements and delusions. But what is a fact, according to the Buddha's teaching, is that many of these defilements revolve around the body. And the consequence of these defilements is suffering and misery. suffering and misery for ourselves, suffering and misery for others. Okay, and what are these defilements that center around the body? Okay, the most obvious, the coarsest, the most obvious is sensual desire, especially in the form of sexual craving. Of course, this is a natural desire. It's part of the instinct towards the propagation of the species. And it is such, as such, it is something that human beings have in common with all forms of life. However, in human beings, this desire becomes blown up out of all proportion, and it loses its place as one drive within the economy of life and turns into an obsession. We find examples of this in numerous domains. One example is advertising. We see how when advertisers have any products to sell, one way to make the product more appealing is to tie it up sometimes in very indirect ways with the natural appeal of sexual desire. If one has a car to sell, the value of the car, whether it's a good car, bad car, has nothing to do with the appearance of the model who sells the car. But if you have the car being displayed by an attractive model, it makes the car much more appealing to a male who's looking to buy the car. In the lobbies of the hotels, high-quality hotels, they always like to have attractive receptionists. The airplanes like to have attractive airline hostesses. We have pop. Who are the goddesses today? We don't have to believe in the Tavatinsa Devaloka, Tusita Devaloka. But the goddesses today are the movie actresses. And why is that? Because of the appearance of beauty. Not only the goddesses, but of course the actors, the devas. I don't see the movies. I just know I know the names. And I've seen the photographs. I've never seen them in movies. Tom Cruise. My knowledge of them, the names, very few. Uma Thurman. Her father is actually a leading Buddhologist. Richard Gere. Yeah. Another deva, god, yeah. If I name the actresses, they're all the ones from the 1950s and early 1960s. And then, of course, there is the pop music. You listen to the... Well, in my days, you listen to the lyrics. I don't know the lyrics nowadays. I think they might have changed. But again, late 1950s, early 1960s, the lyrics all about love. And the love is usually very superficial love, just based upon the appearance of beauty. Oh, you have the most beautiful eyes. Or you look at the poetry, so much of the romantic poetry, the most beautiful face, your hair is like flowing rivers. Yeah, there's a series of suttas, very, very short, at the beginning of the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha says, I do not see one other form, O monks, that so obsesses the mind of a man as the form of a woman. The form of a woman obsesses the mind of a man. That's one sutta. The second is, I do not know of one single sound, O monks, that so obsesses the mind of a man as the sound of a woman. Then the next one, the scent of a woman, the taste of a woman, the touch of a woman. Then maybe you're thinking, ah, the Buddha is being a sexist here, just singling out the women. But then you come to the next five suttas. I do not know of any single form, O monks, that so obsesses the mind of a woman as the form of a man. And it goes, the sound of a man, the scent of a man, the taste of a man, the touch of a man. So this all shows the role of the five senses in one sex in attracting a person of the other sex. Okay, so this so shows sensual desire as a major emotional force which obsesses the mind. It's based on the body. And from the Buddha standpoint, this becomes a hindrance to the development of the mind. First, to the development of the calm concentration needed to bring together the concentrated forces of the mind to develop those higher levels of consciousness that we call samadhi, and then to develop insight, wisdom, which understands things as they truly are. Okay, so one major obstacle is the sensual desire. And I should say that I mentioned some of the, I call them the more innocent manifestations of the sensual desire. But this sensual desire can overstep these innocent boundaries and then take on very pernicious forms. This sort of obsession with sexuality turns into, it manifests in the form of pornography, the obsession with pornography, the exploitation of children for sexual enjoyment, human trafficking, the grabbing of young women, young boys, and forcing them into making them into sex slaves, which has become a multi-billion dollar business throughout the world, especially in the poorer countries of Asia and also now in Eastern Europe, where poorer children, youngsters, are just sometimes, if they're leaving their house to buy something from their parents, these teams of gangsters will just grab them, force them into a car, drive them away, and then the rest of their life is ruined. They're brought off to some other country and just made into sex slaves. Okay, so one major obstacle is this obsession with sensuality. Another is conceit, pride, vanity based on the body. One is always concerned, obsessed with one's physical appearance. How do I look? Am I handsome enough, beautiful enough? Then one starts comparing oneself with others. Especially, I think this is very typical of teenagers. There's in the schools a kind of pecking order, who is the most handsome, the most beautiful. And then people develop very sensitive feelings if they're not as handsome, as beautiful as the others. And because of this, of course, the cosmetic industry becomes a billion-dollar business. And people even go through these operations to change their appearances. And what underlies that obsession with one's appearance, which leads to conceit and vanity on the one hand, there's also anxiety on the other. Fear that one will fall behind if one is not as beautiful, as handsome as the next person. And then this identification with the body manifests itself or crystallizes into a kind of identity view. I am the body. The body is the basis for my identity. And then one comes to identify oneself with a larger unit. I am a member of the white race, white supremacist. We don't want any colored people, black people in this neighborhood, because we are superior. Then the black people say, well, black is beautiful. White people keep out. Then others say, we are of this ethnic group. We are Japanese. We are Chinese. We are Germans, we are French. So everybody has their sense of ethnic identity rooted in the body. So all of these are delusions springing up from the sense of bodily identity. Okay, so the Buddha's teaching is aimed at overcoming all defilements and delusions in their entirety. And it begins, one of the main focal points of these delusions, of these defilements, is the body. There are delusions that center around the mind, around feelings, around consciousness. But one kind of nucleus around which these defilements revolve is the body. So we find in the Buddha's system of meditation, he has the four foundations of mindfulness. And in those four foundations of mindfulness, what is the first one? Contemplation of the body. In the teaching on the five aggregates, what is the first of the five aggregates? The aggregate of bodily form, the rupa khanda. So, the body is one area of investigation, but it's a very important area of investigation. And the Buddha says that in the process of meditative development, one has to take in every domain of experience, bodily and mental. But generally, for most people, one will begin with the body because it's something easier to observe. Then one works from the body inwards towards the mind. The mind is something subtle, and so one comes to the mind last. Okay, as one investigates the body, the aim is eventually to be able to comprehend the body as being stamped with the three characteristics. That is, as being impermanent, as being something bound up with suffering, or as being unsatisfactory, that's dukkha, and then as being devoid of any substantial self, as being anatta. And when one can contemplate or perceive the body as connected with these three characteristics, this brings an end to the identification with the body, and it leads to detachment from the body or disengagement from the body. But for many people, the attraction to the body is a very, very powerful force. And so for such people, this hindrance of sensual desire is a major obstacle that they have to deal with in the process of meditative training. And so for this reason, the Buddha has given specific methods of meditation that are specifically designed to counter the hindrance of sensual desire. In fact, in the training of the monk, the meditation on the unattractive nature of the body, it's traditionally the first meditation subject that's taught. Many people, when they do the formal meditation, they do the mindfulness of breathing. But in the ceremony of ordination, the first instructions in the contemplation of the unattractive nature of the body is given to the novice monk right after the ordination. The first five parts of the body, hairs of the head, hairs of the body, nails, teeth, skin. So that one can begin observing these parts of the body in order to start reducing sensual attachment. Because for a young, newly ordained monk, these might be youngsters in their late teens, they have to deal naturally with the sensual desire that comes up. Okay, now one thing that the Buddha has discovered, and that is that the attitude towards the body, the way we relate to the body, depends upon our perception of the body. So we can say that there is a direct relationship between perception and attitude, and it is perception that conditions the attitude. So if one perceives the body as being something beautiful and attractive, something desirable, and if one continually nurtures thoughts based upon this perception of the body as beautiful, this will give rise to sensual desire, and this will strengthen one's natural sensuality, one's instinctive sensual desire. But one can reverse this tendency by consciously developing the opposite perception. That is, one zooms in on the unattractive nature of the body, the unattractive characteristics of the body, and one builds up a clear, very detailed perception, exploratory perception of the unattractive nature of the body. And then by dwelling upon this perception, one gradually weakens the grip of sensuality upon the mind. And this focusing upon the unattractive nature of the body can become a focal point of concentration in itself, so that one can actually, by zooming in on the unattractive nature of the body, the mind can become concentrated upon that object and actually enter into samadhi that is based upon the unattractive nature of the body. So that this becomes a very important object of concentration in itself. This is called the asubha kamatana, the unattractive meditation object. And so this is why it's not unusual for Buddhist monks in the old days, when bodies used to be just discarded in charnel grounds, they would go to these charnel grounds to view the discarded bodies, even to spend nights there, to see the bodies in different stages of decay, to get a very clear perception of how the body decays and disintegrates. And then they would use this as an object of meditation. Not because they have some morbid fantasies about bizarre fantasies or fascinations with decaying bodies, but it is a way to cleanse the mind of the fascination with sensual desire and to get a very, very clear picture of the nature of the body and the destination of the body. Okay, now we can turn to our sutta, the text of our sutta. And I'm just going to take it in English. I won't read the Pali, but I'm going to give some alternative translations against the Pali, just in a few places. Okay, so now we come to the Vijaya Sutta. Okay, so the text starts off by saying, okay, anyone either walking, standing, sitting, or lying down contracts or stretches his body, such is the motion of the body. This seems like a very simple statement, and when one reads it, one might not quite be able to make the sense or point, to make out the point of the statement. But what this verse is actually calling our attention to is an exercise undertaken in the practice of the Satipatthana method, the method of practicing mindfulness of the body. When one practices mindfulness of the body, as one is simply being aware of the body, one becomes aware of every posture to which the body is subject. And so one centers one's attention, one's awareness in the body itself, and one comes to experience this body as a mass of matter occupying space, which is subject to four main postures. That's walking, standing, sitting, and lying down. And then, in addition to these four main postures, there are two ways in which the body can use its limbs, the four limbs, the arms and legs. It can stretch them out, or it can contract them, bring them in. And so with this, one becomes mindful of the body And now, instead of simply acting unmindfully without awareness, one is now becoming aware of whatever one is doing. So the attention is now being drawn inwards into the body. And one is now experiencing this body almost as a kind of, from a third-person perspective, instead of just automatically identifying with the body and just acting on impulse, one is now aware of every action one is performing. As one walks, one is aware of walking. When stopping, aware of stopping. When sitting, aware of sitting. When lying down, aware of lying down. Then one starts to investigate the body. What is this body made of? What does it consist of? And here one now sees that this body is a structure built up from a framework. The framework, the scaffolding of the body, is the skeleton. That is, it's put together with bones. The bones are held together by sinews. And that is plastered over with flesh filling out the bone structure and covered over with skin. And when we look around us at other people, the bodies around us, what we see is their skin, the hair, eyebrows, sometimes beards, teeth, nails, but we don't see the bones, don't see the flesh, don't see the sinews. All of that is hidden from us, unless we are medical doctors or medical students. In verse 3, here I have to correct the translation. It's not that the Buddha didn't get his anatomy right. The translator didn't get his Pali right. It's not that the Buddha thought that the intestines are in the stomach. But the text says, antapuro udarapuro, which means filled with intestines, filled with stomach. So that means the body, the lower part of the body, it's filled with intestines, filled with the stomach. Then there is that lump called the liver inside. Then the bladder, the heart, lungs, kidneys, and spleen. Now we're investigating the organs inside the body in order to see the inner organs of the body. Now we are moving to get a clearer perception of this unattractive nature of the body. And as we investigate, this is an important point. When we do this, the meditation, the Buddhist teachers, they say, one investigates first using one's own body. That it's very dangerous, risky, to start meditating on the body of others. Because young monk sits there, he thinks, oh, I'm being tempted by images of beautiful women. I'll start contemplating the unattractive nature of the body using image of beautiful women. And then before long, he's just thinking, hair of the head, very nice. skin, oh, such lovely, soft skin. Teeth, such nice smile. It doesn't go any further than that. But one starts using one's own body and going inside one's own body. And then only when one gets very clear perception, strong perception of the unattractive nature of one's own body, does one start working with the bodies of others going externally. Okay, now from the organs of the body, one now starts getting perception of the different fluids in the body. In verse 4, one observes in this body there is mucus, saliva, perspiration, lymph, blood, synovial fluid. That means the fluid in the joints. Then bile, that's the fluid in the liver, is it? The gallbladder, thank you. And fat. Then verse 5 takes us to the excretions from the body. In 9 streams, these impure substances come oozing out. From the eye, I don't think this might, I'm not sure this is right, conjunctivitis, I think it's an eye disease. But it just says from, in the sutta, it just says from the eye comes eye filth. I think what's just meant is, you know, when you get up in the morning sometimes, like these tears and sort of stuff comes out. From the ear, we get earwax. From the nose, mucus, snot. From the mouth, sometimes we get the saliva from the mouth, sometimes vomit, sometimes bile and phlegm. And then from the body comes sweat. And the body attracts dust or picks up dust. And then verse 7 says that the cavity of the head is filled with the brain, but the fool, because of his ignorance, regards it as a something beautiful. I think this "it" here is referring to the body as a whole, not referring to the brain individually. Okay, now all of these verses from verses 2 to 7 are a contemplation of the unattractive nature of the body, of a living body. And this is a kind of contemplation of the body which is done while this body is alive. The systematic way of doing this is through 32 parts of the body explained in the Satipatthana Sutta. I won't describe that meditation right now. At a later time, I'll describe it in more detail. But a brief way that is treated is just in these verses right here. And one could even use these verses as themes for reflection, for contemplation, to build up a very clear perception of the unattractive nature of the body. Just dwelling on these verses, first reciting them, learning them, and then running them through the mind, and then meditating upon them, going through these parts of the body, will help to build up this perception of the unattractive nature of the body. Okay, but let us move on. In the next verse, we are going to come to the channel ground contemplation, which takes us to the observation of the dead body. Here, when the body lies dead, swollen and livid, cast away in the cemetery, the relatives do not care for it. Dogs, jackals, wolves, worms, crows, and vultures, and other living creatures eat it. In the time of the Buddha, it was common for people just to discard a dead body in the cemetery, and then it would become food for wild animals. And as I said before, monks who are practicing this meditation would be able to observe in the cemeteries how the bodies would be eaten and use that as a theme for meditation. Okay, and so verse 10 points out that a monk who is wise, listening to the Buddha's word, or having understood the Buddha's word, fully comprehends the body and sees it in its true perspective. Then the next verse, here it's rather a little bit enigmatic in the original text. It says, in the original text, it says simply, as this, so that. As that, so this. The translator fills in the meaning. That is, as this is, this body is now, so that body, that dead body was, that person who is dead now, was once a living body, talking, laughing, enjoying life, but now it's just a lifeless corpse. And as that is a lifeless corpse, so this body, laughing, joking, enjoying life, full of energy, full of ideas, full of plans, will one day be lying. Bhante, get up! Bhante, get up! Gone. And so, internally and externally, the text says, here the translator, not quite correct, it's not he removes desire for his own body, but he removes desire for the body internally and externally. Removes desire for his own body, that's the attachment to one's own body, and for bodies externally. For the bodies of others. Okay, in the world, such a wise monk who is freed from desire and attachment attains the immortal state, the tranquil, peaceful, and deathless state of Nibbana. Then again, reverting to the impure nature of the body. This body is impure, and that's not intended in a moral way. It's not that the body is evil, but the body is just full of these impure or unattractive substances, bad smelling, and replete with various kinds. Stench is not the good word, but maybe a better translation of foul substances which are trickling out here and there. Then we come, the last verse, important, deals with the removal of conceit. If one possessed of such a body thinks highly of himself, I know, and despises others, that is due to nothing other than his lack of insight or lack of wisdom. So, if one, based upon the body, one thinks, I am better than others. Others looks down at others. Others are worse than myself. That is just due to not understanding the nature of this body. When one understands that we are all just bodies made up of these combinations of bones, flesh, blood, then how can anybody think, I am better, I am worse? Everyone just without a self, nothing mine, nothing I, all selfless, empty, void of any substance. Okay, I thank you all for your attention. May the blessings of the Triple Gem be with you all.